Broadside Books and Harper Audio present The War on the West by Douglas Murray. Read by the author. For My Godchildren. Introduction. In recent years, it has become clear that there is a war going on. A war on the West. This is not like earlier wars, where armies clash and victors are declared. It is a cultural war, and it is being waged remorselessly against all the roots of the Western tradition and against everything good that the Western tradition has produced. At first, this was hard to discern. Many of us sensed that something was wrong. We wondered why one-sided arguments kept being made, and why unfair claims kept being levelled. But we did not realise the full scale of what was being attempted. Not least because even the language of ideas was corrupted. Words no longer meant what they had until recently meant. People began to talk of equality, but they did not seem to care about equal rights. They talked of anti-racism, but they sounded deeply racist. They spoke of justice, but they seemed to mean revenge. It is only in recent years, when the fruits of this movement have come into plain sight, that its scale has become clear. There is an assault going on against everything to do with the Western world, its past, present, and future. Part of that process is that we have become locked in a cycle of unending punishment, with no serious effort at, or even consideration for, its alleviation. In the last decade, I grappled my own way toward understanding this. In 2017, with The Strange Death of Europe, I addressed one aspect of it, which was the changes brought about in the West by mass migration. It had seemed to me, in the years when I covered the immigration question, that something deeper was going on. As I stood on the shores of the Greek and Italian islands, watching the boats come in and mingling in the migrant camps that sprang up in major cities, I saw up close the consequences of the developing world moving into the developed world. I never blamed any migrant for wanting to make that journey. I had been to many of the countries from which the migrants were fleeing. Whether the migrants were fleeing war or, as in the majority of cases, economic deprivation, they were doing something that was very understandable. What I had a problem with was why the Europeans were allowing this to happen and why they were expected to abolish themselves in order to survive. People talked of Europe's having a historic debt that legitimized this movement, but even those who argued this failed to address where the limit to this movement was. Would there ever be a moment when this Western debt would be repaid? Because it seemed that every year the debt was not being paid down, but was increasing. I also began to notice that the same story was playing out across every country that counted as Western. In each of them, the justifications given for allowing this movement of people were the same, despite their very different geographical positions. The United States has for years had its own migration challenge, principally at its southern border. As I travelled throughout America, I heard the same arguments there as I heard back home in Britain and in Europe. A similar type of politician and other public figures kept explaining to the American people why their borders should be lax or entirely porous. As in Europe, there were powerful individuals and entities claiming that the only countries that were civilized were those that let the world in. It was the same in Canada, and it was the same on the other side of the world, in Australia. Everywhere, societies that counted as Western, that is, European countries or countries descended from European civilization, experienced the same pattern of arguments. Nowhere that wasn't Western got any such treatment. Only the Western countries, spread across three continents, were told constantly that in order to have any legitimacy at all, to be even considered decent, they should swiftly and fundamentally alter their demographic makeup. The vision of the 21st century appeared to be that China would be allowed to remain China, the various countries of the Far and Middle East and Africa should be allowed, indeed expected, to remain as they were, or even return to something they may have once been. But the countries identifiable as the countries of the West were expected to become something else or lose all legitimacy. Of course, countries and states have the right to change. Over time, a certain amount of change is inevitable. But there seemed something loaded in what was going on, something unbalanced and off-kilter. The arguments were being made not out of love for the countries in question, but out of a barely disguised loathing for them. In the eyes of many people, not least within their own populations, these countries appeared to have done something wrong, something for which they must atone. The West was the problem. The dissolving of the West was a solution. There were other signs that something was amiss. In 2019, I tackled some of these in The Madness of Crowds. I addressed the challenge raised by identity politics, specifically the attempt to break down Western societies along lines of sex, sexuality, and race. After the 20th century, national identity had become a shameful form of belonging, and all these other forms of belonging suddenly appeared in its place. Now people were being told to consider themselves as members of other specific groupings. They were gay or straight, men or women, black or white. These forms of belonging were also loaded to lean in an anti-Western direction. Gays were celebrated so long as they were queer and wanted to pull down all existing institutions. Gays who just wanted to get on with life or actually liked the Western world were sidelined. Likewise, so long as feminists were attacking male structures, Western capitalism and much more, they were useful. Feminists who didn't toe that line, or thought they were comparatively well off in the West, were treated as sellouts at best, enemies at worst. The discourse on race grew even worse. Racial minorities who had integrated well in the West, contributed to the West, and were even admiring of the West, were increasingly treated as though they were race traitors, as though another allegiance were expected of them. Radicals who wanted to tear everything down were venerated. Black Americans and others who wanted to celebrate the West and add to it were talked to and about as though they were apostates. Increasingly, they were the ones called all the worst names. Love of the society they were in was treated as a point against them. At the same time, it had become unacceptable to talk about any other society in a remotely similar way. In spite of all the unimaginable abuses perpetrated in our own time by the Communist Party of China, almost nobody speaks of China with an iota of the rage and disgust poured out daily against the West from inside the West. Western consumers still buy their clothes cheap from China. There is no widespread attempt to boycott. Made in China is not a badge of shame. Terrible things go on in that country right now, and still it is treated as normal. Authors who refuse to allow their books to be translated into Hebrew are thrilled to see them appear in China. While Chick-fil-A gets more heat for making its sandwiches at home than Nike does for making its sneakers in Chinese sweatshops. Because in the developed West, some different standard applies. With regard to women's rights and sexual minority rights, and of course in particular when it came to the issue of racism, everything was presented as though it had never been worse, at the point at which it had never been better. Nobody could deny the scourge of racism, a scourge that is to be found in some form throughout recorded history. In-group, out-group trends are exceptionally strong in our species. We are not as developed as we might like to imagine we are. Yet, in recent decades, the situation in Western countries in regard to racial equality has been better than ever. Our societies have made an effort to get beyond race, led by the example of some remarkable men and women of every racial background, but most notably by some extraordinary black Americans. It was not inevitable that Western societies would develop, or even aspire to, the tradition of racial tolerance that we have. It was not inevitable that we would end up living in societies that justly regard racism as among the most abhorrent sins. It happened because many brave men and women made the case, fought for that situation, and claimed their rights. In recent years, it has come to sound as though that fight never happened, as though it was a mirage. In recent years, I have come to think of racial issues in the West as being like a pendulum that has swung past the point of correction and into overcorrection. As though if the pendulum stays in a slight overcorrection for long enough, then equality can be more firmly established. By now, it is clear that however well-intentioned such a belief may have been, it was wildly misguided. Race is now an issue in all Western countries in a way it has not been for decades. In the place of colour blindness, we have been pushed into racial ultra-awareness. A deeply warped picture has now been painted. Like all societies in history, all Western nations have racism in their histories. But that is not the only history of our countries. Racism is not the sole lens through which our societies can be understood, and yet it is increasingly the only lens used. Everything in the past is seen as racist, and so everything in the past is tainted. Though, once again, only in the Western past, thanks to the radical racial lenses that have been laid over everything. Terrible racism exists at present across Africa, expressed by black Africans against other black Africans. The Middle East and the Indian subcontinent are rife with racism. Travel anywhere in the Middle East, even to the progressive Gulf states, and you will see a modern caste system at work. There are the higher class racial groups who run these societies and benefit from them. And then there are the unprotected foreign workers, flown in to work for them as an imported labour class. These people are looked down upon, mistreated, and even disposed of as though their lives were worthless. And in the world's second most populated country, as anyone who has travelled through India will know, a caste system remains in vivid and appalling operation. This still goes all the way to regarding certain groups of people as untouchable, for no reason but an accident of birth. It is a sickening system of prejudice, and it is very much alive. Yet, we hear very little about this. Instead, the world gets only a daily report on how the countries in the world that by any measure have the least racism and where racism is most abhorred are the homes of racism. This warped claim even has a final extension, which is that if other countries do have any racism, It must be because the West exported the vice to them. As though the non-Western world is always made up of Edenic innocence. Here again, it is clear that some unfair ledger has been created. A ledger in which the West is treated by one set of standards and the rest of the world by another. A ledger in which it seems that the West can do no right and the rest of the world can do no wrong. Or do wrong only because we in the West made them do it. These are just some of the symptoms that can be discerned in our time. Symptoms that I have tried to take one by one in recent years. But the more I have considered them, and the further across our world that I have travelled, the clearer it has become that this era is defined by one thing above all, a civilizational shift that has been underway throughout our lifetimes, a shift that has been rocking the deep underpinnings of our societies because it is a war on everything in those societies. A war on everything that has marked our societies out as unusual, even remarkable. A war on everything that the people who live in the West had until very recently taken for granted. If this war is to prove unsuccessful, then it will need to be exposed and pushed back against. The War on the West is a book about what happens when one side in a Cold War, the side of democracy, reason, rights, and universal principles, prematurely surrenders. Too often, we frame this fight all wrong. We allow it to be called temporary, or on the fringe, or merely dismiss it as a culture war. We misinterpret the aims of the participants, or downplay the role it will have in the lives of future generations. Yet, the stakes here are as high as any fight in the 20th century, with many of the same principles involved, even with many of the same bad actors. We have gone from appreciating and weighing up what is good about Western culture, to saying that every part of it must be dismantled. It is now over 30 years since the Reverend Jesse Jackson led a crowd of protesters at Stanford University with the chant, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go." Back then, Reverend Jackson and his followers were protesting against Stanford University's introductory program, Western Culture. They proposed that there was something wrong with teaching the Western canon and the Western tradition. But it was what happened next that was so striking. The university swiftly gave in, replacing the study of Western culture with the study of many cultures. What happened at Stanford in 1987 was a sign of everything to come. In the decades that followed, nearly all of academia in the Western world followed Stanford's lead. The history of Western thought, art, philosophy, and culture became an ever less communicable subject. Indeed, it became something of an embarrassment, the product of a bunch of dead white males, to use just one of the charming monikers that entered the language. Since then, every effort to keep alive, let alone revive, the teaching of Western civilization has met with sustained hostility, ridicule, and even violence. Academics who have sought to study Western nations in a neutral light have been prevented from doing their work and subjected to intimidation and defamation, including from colleagues. In Australia, the Ramsay Centre for Western Civilization, whose board is chaired by former Prime Minister John Howard, has tried to find universities to partner with so that students can study Western civilization. They have had great trouble finding any universities willing to work with them. And that tells us something about the speed of this great shift. Just a couple of decades ago, a course in the history of Western civilization was commonplace. Today, it is so disreputable that you can't pay universities to do it. In 1969, the BBC ran Sir Kenneth Clarke's extraordinary 13-part documentary series, Civilization. It aimed to give a unified history of Western civilization, and it did so, informing the understanding of millions of viewers around the world. Almost 50 years later, in 2018, the BBC tried to follow this up. Civilizations, with an emphasis on the S, was a hodgepodge creation of three different historians trying desperately to make sure that they didn't sound as if they were saying the West was better than anywhere else, and giving a sort of world history that made nothing very clear. In a few short decades, the Western tradition has moved from being celebrated to being embarrassing and anachronistic, and, finally, to being something shameful. It turned from a story meant to inspire people and nurture them in their lives into a story meant to shame people. And it wasn't just the term Western that critics objected to. It was everything connected with it. Even civilization itself. As one of the gurus of modern racist anti-racism, Ibram X. Kendi, put it, civilization itself is often a polite euphemism for cultural racism. Of course, some swing of the pendulum is inevitable and may even be desirable. There certainly have been times in the past when the history of the West has been taught as though it is a story of unabashed good. Historical criticism and rethinking are never a bad idea. However, the hunt for visible, tangible problems shouldn't become a hunt for invisible, intangible problems. Especially not if they are carried out by dishonest people with the most extreme answers. If we allow malicious critics to misrepresent and hijack our past, then the future they plan off the back of this will not be harmonious. It will be hell. Over the course of the book, I'm going to be exploring two key ideas. The first is that critics of Western civilization do provide alternatives. They venerate every culture so long as it is not Western. For instance, all native thought and cultural expression are to be celebrated just so long as that native culture is not Western. This is the comparison they want us to make, so we will make it. Two major problems come from celebrating all non-Western cultures. The first is that non-Western countries are able to get away with contemporary crimes as monstrous as anything that happened in the Western past. A habit that some foreign powers encourage. After all, if the West is so preoccupied with denigrating itself, what time could it find to look at the rest of the world? But the other major problem is that it leads to a form of parochial internationalism, where Westerners mistakenly presume that aspects of the Western inheritance are common aspirations across the rest of the globe. From Australia to Canada and America and throughout Europe, a new generation has imbibed the idea that aspects of the Western tradition, such as human rights, are a historical and global norm that have been rolled out everywhere. In time, it has come to seem that the Western tradition that evolved these norms has uniquely failed to live up to them, and that non-Western indigenous cultures are, among much else, purer and more enlightened than Western culture can ever be. These are not fringe views, nor are they new. They stretch back to the 18th century at least. Today, they permeate the work of best-selling authors such as Naomi Klein and Noam Chomsky. These views are taught in universities and schools across the Western world, and their results can be seen in almost every major cultural and political institution. They crop up in the most surprising places. For instance, the National Trust in Britain is meant to exist to keep open many of the country's most beautiful and expensive country houses. The Trust's 5.6 million members tend to enjoy wandering around a stately mansion and then having a spot of afternoon tea. But in recent years, the Trust has decided it has another job: to educate its visitors about the horrors of the past. And not just connections to empire and the slave trade, homophobia and the crimes of primogeniture. It has recently chosen to push the idea that the English countryside itself is racist, and is, as the Trust's programme director calls it, a green, unpleasant land. I select that one example, but you can select almost any area of life and find that it has been similarly denounced. Everything from art, mathematics and music to gardening, sport and food has been put through the same spin cycle. There are many curiosities in all this. Not the least of them is that while the West is assaulted for everything it has done wrong, it now gets no credit for having got anything right. In fact, these things, including the development of individual rights, religious liberty and pluralism, are held against it. This leads us to a second, deeper puzzle. Why open everything in the West to assault? The culture that gave the world life-saving advances in science, medicine, and a free market that has raised billions of people around the world out of poverty and offered the greatest flowering of thought anywhere in the world is interrogated through a lens of the deepest hostility and simplicity. The culture that produced Michelangelo, Leonardo, Bernini, and Bach is portrayed as if it has nothing relevant to say. New generations are taught this ignorant view of history. They are offered a story of the West's failings without spending anything like a corresponding time on its glories. Every school child now knows about slavery. How many can describe, without irony, cringing, or caveat, the great gifts that the Western tradition has given to the world? All aspects of the Western tradition now suffer the same attack. The Judeo-Christian tradition that formed a cornerstone of the Western tradition finds itself under particular assault and denigration. But so does the tradition of secularism and the Enlightenment, which produced the flourishing in politics, sciences, and the arts. And this has consequences. A new generation does not appear to understand even the most basic principles of free thought and free expression. Indeed, these are themselves portrayed as products of European Enlightenment and attacked by people who don't understand how or why the West came to the settlements that it did over religion, nor how the prioritizing of the scientific method allowed people around the world untold improvements in their lives. Instead, these inheritances are criticized as examples of Western arrogance, elitism, and undeserved superiority. As a result, everything connected with the Western tradition is being jettisoned. At education colleges in America, aspiring teachers have been given training seminars where they are taught that even the term diversity of opinion is white supremacist bullshit. This book is not a history of the West and does not aim to be. Such a work would have to be many times this length. Nor do I wish to shut down the considerable debate that is going on at the moment. I enjoy that debate and think it helpful. But to date, it has been riotously one-sided. As we will see, it has involved politicians, academics, historians, and activists getting away with saying things that are not simply incorrect or injudicious, but flat-out false. They have got away with it for far too long. There are many facets to this war on the West. It is carried out across the media and airwaves, throughout the education system, from as early as preschool, It is rife within the wider culture, where all major cultural institutions are either coming under pressure or actually volunteering to distance themselves from their own past. And it now exists at the very top of the American government, where one of the first acts of the new administration was to issue an executive order calling for equity and the dismantling of what it called systemic racism. We appear to be in the process of killing the goose that has laid some very golden eggs. Chapter 1. Race. There is an obvious, observable truth about people in the West. Historically, the citizens of Europe and their offspring societies in the Americas and Australasia have been white. Not absolutely everybody has been, but the majority have. The definition is tautological. White means mostly having ancestors from Europe. Just as the majority of people in Africa have been black, and the majority of people in the Indian subcontinent have been brown. If, for some reason, you wished to level an assault on everything to do with Africa, you might well at some point decide to target people for being black. If you wanted to delegitimize everything about Indians, you might, at some stage, decide to attack its people for the color of their skin. Both would be inhumane and would today be easily identified as such. But, in the war on the West, white people are one of the first subjects of attack, a fact that has been steadily normalized and made into the only acceptable form of racism in the societies in which it happens. To delegitimize the West, it appears to be necessary first to demonize the people who still make up the racial majority in the West. It is necessary to demonize white people. Sometimes the results of this play out in front of everybody's eyes. In August 2021, the results of the US census that had been carried out the previous year were released. One of the headline facts was that the number of white people in America had declined. On his Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon mentioned this in his lead monologue. "The results of the 2020 census just came out," he told his studio audience and viewers at home. "And, for the first time in American history, the number of white people went down." In response to this, the studio audience whooped and cheered uproariously. For them, it was not just funny news, but good news. Not that the percentage of whites went down, but that the actual number of white people alive went down. And though this might come as a surprise to some people, for many of us, this ugly movement had been growing for years. In February 2016, I was in a large hall in London speaking as a second alongside John Allen, the American four-star general and former commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan. We were taking part in a debate over what to do with the Islamist group ISIS. In addition to rampaging across the Middle East, the group had already carried out attacks in Europe. Foremost on all of our minds that night were the multiple suicide bombings and Kalashnikov attacks that had taken place across Paris a short while earlier, taking the lives of 130 people. Although ISIS bombers had not yet hit the United Kingdom, I used my speech to warn the audience that if ISIS weren't stopped, then some evening soon, perhaps in a hall like the one we were in, perhaps aimed at a younger audience, perhaps targeting a pop concert, ISIS would strike. And when they did, we would wonder what the hell we had been doing, ignoring them as they built up their forces in Syria and Iraq. General Allen used his remarks to give a deeply measured summary of how to defeat ISIS. His speech was technical, impressive, slightly dull, but careful to stress his respect for Arab allies on the ground and across the region. Our opponents that night appeared to have listened, but it was something that one of them said at the opening of her speech that stuck with us. After we had both spoken, one of our opponents, a Palestinian activist and writer called Ruler Jibril, opened by explaining why the audience should not bother listening to what either General Allen or I had to say. "We're again lectured, with all due respect," she said, which in this context always means none, "by two white men." I had heard it before, but I noticed the general wince slightly. The comment was clearly still playing on his mind afterward at dinner, because he picked up on it again. "Have you had that before?" he asked me. I said that, regrettably, I had, and was only shocked that he had not. "I never had that," he said. He had spent his life serving in the US military, risking his life, living among the people of Afghanistan, on deployment for years on end, and he seemed genuinely surprised that this, and all the rest of his life and experience, should be summed up and dismissed through the fact that he happened to be a white man. And lumped in with me, to boot. "Well, I'd get used to it," I told him breezily, little realizing how fast we all would. That was only a few years ago. But still then, outside of academic circles and racist organizations, it was deemed discourteous to lump people together and dismiss them simply because of the color of their skin. An earlier generation had come to the sensible conclusion that dismissing people, vilifying them, or generalizing about them simply because of the color of their skin was the definition of racism. And racism had become viewed as among the ugliest of human evils. Fail to take people into account as individuals, and we knew where it could lead. To the horrors of the mid-20th century, to the nightmares of Rwanda and Bosnia at the end of that century. Closer to home, it led to the racial segregation and occasional racial violence that had scarred America's past, as it had the past of so many other countries. The lesson had seemed clear. Treat people as individuals, and reject those who would try to reduce them to membership of a group they belonged to solely by accident of birth. The message of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. seemed to have triumphed. The future was meant to be one in which racial categories mattered less and less. Society and the people in it would aspire to be colorblind, just as they also aspired to be sex-blind and blind to differences in an individual's sexual orientation. The aim of society seemed clear, and with some skirmishes still remaining around the edges, was agreed upon across the political spectrum. People should be able to fulfill their potential, unhampered by the chance of group characteristics. Anyone who wanted to play with racist rhetoric or find people willing to excuse racism had to mingle with the residue of white supremacists in their increasingly small enclaves, or find a home among equally fringe groups such as Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam with their black supremacy. Such groups were far from the political or social center or mainstream, and the center seemed to want to keep it that way. Then, in the early years of the present century, this began to change. A vogue began for referring to race more than anyone had in years. Specifically, it led to an upsurge of descriptions of white people in terms that could be used about no other group in society. Commonly, it was people who were white themselves who did most of the running, or rather, pleading. But it broke out in an extraordinarily wide range of venues. As usual with bad ideas, they originated in the universities. Critical race theory. Despite the waning number of overtly racist laws and the power of overt racists in the United States, the disparate results between whites and blacks eroded very slowly. Academics began looking for hidden mechanisms of racism to account for this. Critical race theory, CRT, emerged over decades in academic seminars, papers, and publications. From the 1970s onwards, academics such as Bell Hooks, the pretentious lower cases are intended, Derek Bell at Harvard and Stanford, and Kimberly Crenshaw, UCLA and Columbia, worked to create a movement of activists within academia who would interpret almost everything in the world through the lens of race. In some ways, their obsession was understandable. Bell, for instance, had grown up during the very last years of segregation. During his time at Harvard, there were only a handful of black faculty members. Instead of taking the incrementalist approach favored by others, those who formed the bases for CRT first asserted that race was the most significant factor in hiring decisions at Ivy League universities, and then that it was the single most important lens through which to understand wider society. Meaning that at the very moment that things were improving and more black faculty members were coming through, everything in the academy, and everything in the academy's understanding of wider society, was racialized. Or rather, racialized anew. Of course, there were obvious and clear counters to this. The Civil Rights Act had been passed and working for years. Anti-discrimination laws were already on the statute books and growing in number, yet followers of CRT saw nearly all progress in American race relations as an illusion. That is how Bell himself referred to it in 1987, when he wrote that progress in American race relations is largely a mirage, obscuring the fact that whites continue, consciously or unconsciously, to do all in their power to ensure their dominion and maintain their control. When Harvard failed to give tenure to two followers of CRT in 1986, Bell and others staged a sit-in at the university. Like any revolutionary sect, the followers of CRT knew how to make themselves felt and heard, and knew how to change the intellectual weather in a corner of society not known for its heroism. The more places scholars could see invisible racism, the more popular they became. Naturally, it was the case that very few people who this ideology was coming for knew what was coming for them. Even if they had known, they would have found it hard to oppose. Because one of the distinguishing marks of CRT was that its assertions were based not on evidence, as it might previously have been understood, but essentially on interpretations and attitudes. This marked a significant shift in the manner in which people were expected to prove assertions. While rarely announcing the fact, the rules of CRT had no need for normal standards of evidence. If a person's lived experience could be attested to, then the question of evidence or data had to find a place further back in the queue, if at all. The intersectionalists who grew up at the same time comfortably overlapped with CRT. These people, who built a theory from the assertion that all oppressions intersect and must be simultaneously solved, made this leap possible. Suddenly, academic papers were able to be produced, most famously by Peggy McIntosh at Wellesley, that consisted of nothing more than lists of assertions, all made from a standpoint which was neither provable nor disprovable. It was simply asserted. Whether levelling claims against colleagues or against wider society, it became sufficient to fall back simply on the evidence of one's own perceptions. If one person pointed to evidence that proved America had become less racist, another person could say that he knew this not to be the case. Why? His own lived experience, as though there is any other kind. In many ways, it was a clever move to make. For it is true that no individual's personal experience can ever be fully comprehended. But neither can it be always and wholly believed. Certainly, assertions about entire societies and groups of people should come with some evidence attached. Well, not now. At its best, the shift from evidence to me allowed a stalemate. You have your views and reality, I have mine. At its worst, it left any exchange of ideas vulnerable to being taken over by bad faith actors who simply insisted that things are as they say they are. And that is precisely what happened. One of the distinguishing marks of CRT is that from the outset, its advocates and adherents have been remarkably clear about what they want and how they intend to get it. CRT's progenitors, followers and admirers, laid out their stall early and often. For instance, the claim that CRT is not a school of thought or set of propositions, but a movement, is something that is admitted to by its own apostles. In their 2001 work, Critical Race Theory, An Introduction, the authors Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik admiringly described CRT as a movement consisting of a collection of activists and scholars interested in studying and transforming the relationship among race, racism, and power. The movement considers many of the same issues that conventional civil rights and ethnic studies discourses take up, but places them in a broader perspective that includes economics, history, context, group and self-interest, and even feelings and the unconscious. Unlike traditional civil rights, which embraces incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. That is quite the list of things to question. The principles of the Enlightenment, the law, neutralism, rationalism, and the very foundations of the liberal order? Had this been written about CRT by an enemy, that would be one thing. But this was written by its adherents, about themselves. What is more, as Delgado and Stefanchik boasted, although CRT started in the realm of law, it has rapidly spread beyond that discipline throughout all fields of education. Today, many in the field of education consider themselves critical race theorists who use CRT's ideas to understand issues of school discipline and hierarchy, tracking, controversies over curriculum and history, and IQ achievement testing. Unlike some academic disciplines, critical race theory contains an activist dimension. It not only tries to understand our social situation, but to change it. It sets out not only to ascertain how society organizes itself along racial lines and hierarchies, but to transform it for the better. This is an unusual language for academics to write in. To boast that a particular collection of academics and teachers are, in fact, academics with an activist dimension. And as for the admission that CRT seeks not just to understand society, but to transform it, this is the language of revolutionary politics, not a language traditionally used in academia. But revolutionary activists were exactly what those involved in CRT turned out to be. The hallmarks were there from the beginning. An absolute obsession with race as the primary means to understand the world and all injustice. The claim is that white people are in their totality guilty of prejudice, specifically racism, from birth. That racism is interwoven so deeply into white majority societies that the white people in those societies do not even realize that they live in racist societies. Asking for proof was proof of racism. And finally, there is also the insistence that none of the answers Western societies have come up with to address racism are remotely adequate or capable of dealing with the task at hand. The work of Eduardo Bonilla Silva and others insisted that even the concept of aspiring to be colorblind when it comes to issues of race is itself deeply racist. But what was racism by this new and assertive definition? It was repeatedly asserted, prejudice plus power. Partly thanks to the influence of Michel Foucault, these academics had become obsessed with the issue of power. They saw it both as the central issue of a free society and as being wielded negatively by all state institutions. As a result, the priority was to wrestle power out of these hands and wield it elsewhere. Attributing power, or taking power on the basis of skin colour, was enormously advantageous to these academics, even if their thinking on the matter remained wildly confused. For instance, they maintained that someone could not be guilty of racism if they had no power, even if they were prejudiced. And in the power structure that devotees of CRT remorselessly laid out, it was axiomatic that only white people had power. Therefore, only white people could be racist. Black people either could not be racist, or, if they were racist only because they had internalized whiteness. Of course, while all of this was taking place in universities across America, most Americans were able to remain blissfully ignorant of it. And while it is certainly possible to underestimate what a group of activist scholars might be able to accomplish, it is also possible to overestimate their impact. For most Americans, the work of Crenshaw, Bell, and others need not have touched their lives at all. But out in the wider world, in the realm of popular entertainment, some of these habits started to catch on. Attitudes that had been marginal shifted to the mainstream. Claims that would only recently have been regarded as esoteric took on a life of their own. For example, in 2001, the opinion documentary maker Michael Moore cranked out a number one best-selling book called Stupid White Men. Its chapters included one titled Kill Whitey. During its course, Moore reeled off a list of the crimes he blamed on white people. They included, though were not limited to, the Black Plague, warfare, chemicals, the internal combustion engine, the Holocaust, slavery, the genocide of Native Americans, and job layoffs in corporate America. As Moore concluded, "You name the problem, the disease, the human suffering, or the abject misery visited upon millions, and I'll bet you $10 I can put a white face on it." Perhaps Moore had never heard of the problems of Rwanda, Sierra Leone, or Myanmar, to name just a few places. Here, and throughout his accompanying tours, speeches, and documentaries, Moore made himself rich and famous by asserting that white people, or whitey, as he persisted, were responsible for everything bad. Everyone else was just a victim. Naturally, many people disliked this sort of talk. They recognized the truth of Thomas Sowell's 2012 observation that if racism in America is not dead, then it is certainly on life support. They knew the claims starting to be hurled out against their societies to be false, unfair, and much more, but they failed to take into account Sowell's follow-on observation that racism was now being kept alive by politicians, race hustlers, and people who get a sense of superiority by denouncing others as racists. These exact figures were the ones who now gave racism a new lease on life. They did so by two means in particular. The first was by declaring a change of rules. The second was in announcing themselves to be the referees. In doing so, among much else, they identified and cut off all the paths that a normal person would have to avoid being accused of being a racist. If you were unable to see it everywhere, It was only because your racism prevented you from really looking. In 2018, an obscure academic called Robin DiAngelo, who also happened to be white, published a book which brought together a number of her recent writings under the title White Fragility. It became DiAngelo's contention not only that white people were all racist, but that white people who disliked being told that they were racist, or objected to being called racist, were simply providing further evidence of their racism. This logical trap is the same one favoured by witch dunkers in the Middle Ages. If the woman drowns, she is innocent. If she floats, she is a witch and can be burned. In DiAngelo's logic, the person who denies that they are racist is racist, and so is the person who says they are racist, meaning that the best thing to do in any given situation is for a person to save time and confess to being a racist. That suited the man who wrote the foreword to her book. There, Michael Eric Dyson actually declared that Robin DiAngelo is the new racial sheriff in town. He went on, "She is bringing a different law and order to bear upon the racial proceedings." This new law and order included the naming of guilty parties. Describing racism as America's original sin, Dyson insisted, "We cannot possibly name the nemeses of democracy or truth or justice or equality if we cannot name the identities to which they have been attached. For most of our history, straight white men have been involved in a witness protection program that guards their identities and absolves them of their crimes while offering them a future free of past encumbrances and sins." Describing DiAngelo's tortuous work as beautiful, he added that it is a bracing call to white folk everywhere to see their whiteness for what it is and to seize the opportunity to make things better now. Robin DiAngelo kicks all the crutches to the side and demands that white folk finally mature and face the world they've made while seeking to help remake it for those who have neither their privilege nor their protection. It is a list of assertions that is worth pausing over. The idea that white people are all immature, for instance, might easily slide by, coming as it does alongside the claim that straight white men are all racist criminals. Yet none of these assertions seemed far-fetched, given the assertions made inside the book Dyson was writing about. In her very first line, DiAngelo wrote, "The United States was founded on the principle that all people are created equal, yet the nation began with the attempted genocide of indigenous people and the theft of their land. American wealth was built on the labor of kidnapped and enslaved Africans and their descendants." And then she went on, like Dyson, to list the things that all white people think, believe, and do, such as to claim that anti-blackness is foundational to our very identities as white people. If DiAngelo knew that what she was doing was in some way bad, she didn't seem to mind it. In fact, she happily admitted to it, writing, "I am breaking a cardinal rule of individualism. I am generalizing." Until this point, generalizing about people had indeed been deemed to be a low tactic. To say all Chinese people think this, or all black people behave like that, had been thought to be rude as well as ignorant. But Robin DiAngelo positively revelled in the naughtiness of doing it and getting away with doing it, because she was doing it against white people. In the same way, it had been thought, until the fairly recent past, to be at the very least rude to condemn people for traits over which they had no say, and claim that these traits were in fact without any merits at all. But DiAngelo enjoyed breaking that ethic too. "There are many positive approaches to anti-racist work," she wrote. One of them is to try to develop a positive white identity. However, a positive white identity is an impossible goal. White identity is inherently racist. White people do not exist outside the system of white supremacy. And yet, D'Angelo says that white people should not stop identifying as being white, for to do so would be to deny racism and constitute colorblind racism. What is her positive suggestion for her readers? They should strive to be less white, is her answer, adding, for the sake of clarity, that to be less white is to be less racially oppressive. If it was true that white Americans were inextricably racist, yet also fragile about that fact, it did not stop them from buying D'Angelo's big book of generalizations. In fact, they bought it in great piles. D'Angelo's book sold over 750,000 copies. And perhaps it was because of the acclaim and commercial success that D'Angelo was emboldened to make more extreme claims in her later interviews. In an interview on Amanpour and Company in 2018, she claimed that white people find racism exciting and enjoy indulging in it. D'Angelo's interviewer on this occasion, Michelle Martin, who happens to be black, tried to pin her guest down on such claims. "Why do you say that, though?" Martin asked. "You're a scholar. Where's your data? What makes you say that?" D'Angelo may or may not be a scholar, but she had no evidence to back up her claims. Instead, she simply made another, unrelated assertion. "There is a kind of glee in the white collective when black bodies are punished." That interview was broadcast again 2 years later after its first showing, because 2 years later, everything had changed again. George Floyd had been killed by the policeman Derek Chauvin, and footage of the death had been broadcast around the world. Protests broke out worldwide, and D'Angelo's book was one of those that benefited from the spike of interest in anti-racism. In just a month after Floyd's death, White Fragility sold almost 500,000 copies. There is something in that moment that is worth confronting right away, because there are those for whom the killing of George Floyd was not just something that happened in America, but something that was emblematic of America. And this perspective, that what happened that day was not the behavior of a rogue cop who was subsequently arrested, tried, convicted, and imprisoned for his crime, but rather a pulling back of the curtain and a revealing of something in the heart of all white Americans, was an interpretation that D'Angelo, the critical race theorists, and others had primed Americans for, and primed college-aged Americans for in particular. Polls showed that positive views on the state of race relations in America peaked at the time of President Obama's inauguration in 2009. At that time, a CBS New York Times poll found that 66% of Americans thought that race relations were generally good. But, as it tracked the polls over the following years, the Associated Press noted that views on race started to sour in 2014. One interpretation of this is that America became more racist over the two terms of its first black president. Another is that the media attention on certain incidents, whether justifiable or not, helped to alter America's view of itself. What made this worse was that a generation of students brought up with elements of CRT had been persuaded that race relations in their country were wildly worse than they were. People in the American Academy had invented and popularized a whole set of concepts and terms to help this along. just as their colleagues in the intersectional arena insisted on the idea that everyone lived in a cis-heteronormative patriarchy, so the professors of CRT introduced a set of racialized terms into the academic language and from there into the nation's language. They argued, for instance, that America was not merely a white-dominated society, or that America had a white-majority population, but a white-supremacist society. They claimed that all white people benefited from allowing white supremacist rule. They claimed that when confronted by their racism, white people deliberately changed the subject or made themselves into the victims. They claimed that there was a specific phenomenon known as white tears, and a subcategory within that, white women's tears. They also claimed that whiteness was contagious. For how else to deal with the fact that many black people were not in 100% agreement with the new racial theorists and did not all agree with the new ideas being foisted upon everyone? One answer was to claim that black people who were not in agreement that America was an intrinsically racist society were enacting whiteness, or otherwise imbibing it, like some terrible disease. After the 2020 US presidential election, the Washington Post even introduced its readers to the concept of multiracial whiteness as a way to explain how ethnic minorities might have voted for the Republican candidate. In these settings, in which you could get black white people, though not white black people, it becomes clear that black and white had simply become synonyms for good and bad. Advocates of this theory claimed that race was not just one lens through which to view society. They insisted that it was the most important, in fact, the only lens through which to view society. And much of the venom and fury that exists today in America and in the West as a whole now comes down to this one specific problem: that people have been shown a version of their society that is exaggerated at best and wildly off at worst. Take just one, perhaps the most famous racist event of recent years, the storm that blew CRT and its theories across the whole Western world, the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May 2020. In the days, weeks, and months after that terrible event, there was barely an organ or an individual in America or the wider world that did not interpret the appalling video of that death through a single lens: that a white policeman was caught on camera killing a black man, and that this was a racist killing. Not content with that explanation, everything about this interpretation was then extrapolated outward. This was not just an individual racist killing, it was a racist killing that told us about the nature of racist policing in America. From there, it went out again. We learned that this racist policing was just one aspect of a wider racist society, and from there that not just America, but all white-dominated societies, and societies in which white people simply had a presence, were somehow revealed in that moment. The interpretation that was popularized across the globe was that what happened to George Floyd told us about a routine injustice. It claimed that black lives were able to be stolen with impunity in modern America, and that this was because America and the wider West was institutionally racist, white supremacist, and otherwise guilty of a no longer avoidable bigotry. Actual public understanding of the issue turned out to be wildly, provably out of sync with reality. For instance, When U.S. citizens were polled and asked how many unarmed black Americans they believed had been shot by police in 2019, the numbers were off by several orders of magnitude. 22% of people who identified as very liberal said they thought the police shot at least 10,000 unarmed black men in a year. Among self-identified liberals, fully 40% thought that the figure was between 1,000 and 10,000. The actual figure was somewhere around 10. By proportion of the population, unarmed black Americans were slightly more likely to be shot by the police than unarmed white Americans. But, as figures compiled by the Washington Post Police Shootings Database confirm, in the years before the death of George Floyd, more police officers were killed by black Americans than unarmed black Americans were killed by the police. Almost none of this cut through. But the polls seemed to suggest that increased reporting on this issue in the 2010s may have had the inadvertent effect of causing Americans to imagine that the problem of deadly interactions between unarmed black men and the police was exponentially worse than before. Whatever the realities of race in America, a group of divisive activists were ready for this moment. With their pre-prepared theories, phrases, claims, and demands about eradicated hidden racism. And they got very busy indeed. That was why sporting teams across the world began to take the knee before every match. They were inveigled into thinking they had to do so to demonstrate that they were against racist killing, that black people were freely killed by policemen, and that they should not be. That is why politicians across the West took the knee and gave speeches against racism. It is why Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and the rest of the leadership of the Democratic Party wore African kente cloth scarves and kneeled for 8 minutes 46 seconds before being winched back up again by their attendants. It is why the idea of educating yourself if you were white suddenly entered the popular lexicon. It is why CEOs, such as the editor-in-chief of National Geographic, started to put under their name and title as a sign-off, race card, white, privileged, with much to learn. It was a moment when silence in the face of racism was deemed to be violence, a moment when actual violence was excused as a form of legitimate political speech, a moment an academic could blithely declare that the state of black America as a whole is probably worse than it was 50 years ago. It was at this moment, in the days after Floyd's death, that concepts such as white privilege spilt out from the fringes of academia where they had been incubated and flooded through every part of society. So it is worth pointing out a potentially unpopular but nevertheless crucial fact about this origin story, which is that there is still no evidence that the killing of George Floyd was a racist murder. At the trial of Derek Chauvin, no evidence was produced to suggest that it was a racist murder. If there had been any such evidence that Chauvin harbored deep animus against black Americans and set out that May morning hoping to murder a black person, then the prosecution chose to make no such evidence available at Chauvin's trial. In fact, there is good evidence to suggest that no racial element existed at all. How can we say that? One reason is that 4 years before Floyd's death, on August 10, 2016, another man was killed in almost the exact same horrific circumstances as was Floyd. 32-year-old Tony Timper was killed in Dallas while being detained by 5 police officers. He himself called 911 from a parking lot, saying that he was afraid and needed assistance. He told the services that he suffered from depression and schizophrenia and had failed to take his medicine. He was reportedly off his mental health medication, though he had, like Floyd, taken other drugs. The detention and death of Tony Timper, like those of George Floyd, was caught on camera, this time in police body cam footage. Like Floyd, Timper was unarmed. And like Floyd, his death was horribly, brutally protracted. Like Floyd, the policeman detaining Timper could hardly have come across as more callous, entitled, or flippant in dealing with the life of a man. Timper can be heard in the footage wailing and pleading with police as he is handcuffed and pinned to the ground by his shoulders, knees, and neck. Just as George Floyd yelled that he couldn't breathe,